Hi everyone, welcome to the podcast. In lieu of the usual podcast, this week I'm going to present a lecture. I'm titling this my canceled lecture because this lecture was canceled, and I don't think that's ever happened to me before by the sponsor because they didn't like some of the content that's herein. I'm going to lecture today about what I've learned in rheumatology in the last 40 years, some rules, some things that are my point of view. And you see if you can find in here something that you find objectionable. The title of this talk is Lifetime Lessons in Rheumatology, They Keep Changing. So first, let me begin with rheumatoid arthritis. Let me resize my screen so I'm not so big. And so let's begin with seronegative RA. I love that Ronan Kavanaugh spoke about a lesson he learned from a colleague that said, when you're seeing a seronegative RA patient, it's your opportunity to revisit the diagnosis at each visit. So I like this paper from Tulicki-Soka about 430 early seronegative RA patients followed for 10 years, and only 3% became erosive or seropositive over their 10-year follow-up. A third could not be reclassified, but 65% were reclassified, mostly being either PMR, PSA, psoriatic arthritis, osteoarthritis, or CPPD. And you can see there that the range here on possibilities is 16% for PSA and 3.9% for CPPD. This was recently reinforced by another paper that came out in RMD Open saying 364 RA patients, all 26% of them were seronegative. That's 96 out of the 364. But when they reviewed those patients, nearly 20% of them met ACR criteria for the diagnosis of CPPD. Again, seronegative is a serious subset. You should think about alternative diagnoses over time. The usual paradigm that most of us follow is first we use methotrexate, second we use a TNF inhibitor, and usually we do a second and a third before we switch to another class of therapies. You assess patients after 12 weeks of monitoring. You only use other mechanism action drugs after you fail TNF inhibitors at least twice, and you tend not to use rituximab. JAKs tend to be second and third line, and you're all wanting to use a biomarker. My paradigm is I use methotrexate first, but I use it differently. Methotrexate's cheaper and it's certainly better than JAKs, but JAKs are better. Push come to shove, when JAKs are better, they're going to get used first. I do 6 weeks follow-up, and I want to change therapies as soon as I can to get to remission as soon as I can. After the first TNF failure, I'll use another MOA drug, and there's good reasons and good data to support that. I don't do Vectra, Prism, or AVICE testing. I have an algorithm for difficult RA, and let me start by showing you my methotrexate regimen. So, starting dose is 15 milligrams a week. I escalate to 17 and a half and 20. I rarely go above that. My top dose could be 25. Once I'm at 15 milligrams, everybody gets split dose oral, meaning it's 7.5 BID on the same day each week, because you get almost 100% absorption. At 15 or higher, you don't get very good absorption. If I don't get a good response, I continue the methotrexate and I add on. If you have oral ulcers or diarrhea, I give you vitamin A every day. Look it up. It works. Look it up on my website and you'll see why. If you have CNS effects of methotrexate, the blahs as being the most common, seeing up to 50% of patients, everybody gets dextromethorphan, usually in the form of Mucinex quifenicin with DM. And you give one pill or one dose of that with your first dose of methotrexate and another with the second dose, and maybe a third dose that works in 80% of people. I used to not use methotrexate in PSA, and I think the PSA SEAM trial said I should, and I do. It's okay to use it with ILD and with NASH, and that's according to 2021 ACR guidelines. And when I'm going to give a vaccine, I always hold methotrexate for one dose with all vaccines. That includes influenza, pneumovax, and COVID. Difficult to treat RA is a big problem. You got to recognize not all of these patients have synovitis. Not all of these patients need your best and last resort biologic or the drug you haven't used. A lot of them are damaged and they're too far gone. A lot of them are going to respond to nothing for no good reason. A lot of them have HEL traits. What are HEL traits? These are the non-compliant. These are the negativistic thinkers. These are poor patient managers. The intelligent and the assertive can be a problem because they often think they know more than you. The vaccinauts, that special thinking, poor sleepers and fibromyalgia patients, and those in denial are the ones with health traits. Go through the checklist. Rethink the diagnosis, especially if seronegative. If they have pain and damage, it needs a team approach. Often, pain and damage will often need imaging. So, if you're unsure of the problem of the pain or the nature of their ongoing activity, get imaging to help you make your decision. Treat inflammation with another MOA. If you have no objective signs of inflammation, you should be thinking other things. Avoid polypharmacy, deal with depression and bad behaviors. Ask the patient what they want, and don't be handcuffed by safety. There's always a good answer, and ask someone who knows. Call me, call your friend who's good at lung disease. And again, if they have systemic inflammation, then maybe you can take my approach, which is to reboot the patient with a control, alt, delete, and that's what's shown here. Control is what drugs, worked in the past. Delete means what drugs they won't take or what drugs they failed. An alternative means what drugs have you not yet tried? And these are regimens I can use in the minority of people with D2T RA who merit an aggressive anti-inflammatory immunosuppressive combination. And then there's this prescribing based on what the safety concern is. So after you fail methotrexate and maybe your first TNF inhibitor, then a lot of the choices you're going to make are based on what the problem is. Here I show you what the problems could be. Past serious infections, or worry about serious infections, or about mycobacteria, or opportunistic, or zoster, or liver disease, or diverticulitis, or they have coexistent IBD, a worry about cancer, lymphoma, cardiovascular, pregnancy, and VTEs. And this slide, which you can get from Room Now, shows you the things that you shouldn't use on the left and the things that you should use on the right. So let me choose, for instance, you have Crohn's or UC. You probably shouldn't be using an IL-17 inhibitor or prednisone as your first option, but it is okay to use a TNF inhibitor, a JAK inhibitor, a 12/23 inhibitor, and that makes sense, right? Get this from Room Now. I want to talk about switching. So if you fail a TNF, regardless of whatever the problem is, if you switch to a non-TNF as your second choice, you're always going to do as well as if you do a second TNF. When you go from the first TNF to the second TNF, you always lose 10 points in responsiveness. Your 60-40-20 goes to a 50-30-10. Here's the results of the Accelerate study, a head-to-head trial of patients taking two different TNF inhibitors, sertolizumab and adalimumab. And you can see in the first 12 weeks, if you're a non-responder, you switch to the alternative, the other drug. Look at what happens here. That the 80% response rate to the first TNF inhibitor, when you switch to the other one for non-response and primary non-response, it drops down to 40%. Now, in practice, it goes at least to 10. But the idea, this is why you probably want to switch to another MOA. And here's another study of which there are many showing you that for people who fail the TNF inhibitor, especially the first, they switch to either rituximab or another TNF inhibitor, rituximab outperforms it. There are a lot of reasons to use another drug. I'll allow a second TNF if the reason for failure was a secondary non-response or toxicity non-response, but otherwise, I'm switching to another MOA. Get a lot of questions about infection rules. Infections are a big problem in both RA and lupus. They're a number one cause of death and hospitalization. Pneumonia is usually the number one cause of a serious infectious event. Risk factors in RA would be older, underlying lung disease, steroid use, seropositivity, disease activity, and a prior pneumonia. A prior SIE makes it more likely you're going to get another SIE. So here are my rules. Infection is more related to inflammation, disease activity, than it is to the drug you're worried about. And that's been shown over and over and over again. Number two, everybody gets their education on infection concerns from television ads. Not a good source. That's why the surgeon and the next door neighbor and the patient, are like, oh my God, I got to stop the biologic because of an infection. No, you don't. All right. RA has a higher rate of non-serious infectious events as compared to serious infections, up to 50%. In fact, Steroids are the dangerous drug that you need to minimize. Biologics can add to infection risk only in the worst possible patients. Early patients, first-time biologic users, biologics don't add much to the infectious risk. Infectious risk is dominated by age and comorbidities and disease activity and steroids. Opportunistic infections and the bad infections you worry about are a 1 in 1,000 risk. The problem is that these opportunistic infections may have a very high mortality rate, so you don't want to miss them, and you do have to worry about them. Suspect a pathogen based on the target drug. We do know, for instance, TNF inhibitors, you need to suspect mycobacterial species, either TB itself or non-tuberculous mycobacterial infections, atypical TBs. And rule number eight, I don't stop or hold a biologic with an infection. I stop and hold a biologic when the patient's hospitalized with a fever of greater than 101 or 102. So reduce infectious risk by decreasing steroids, stopping steroids. Two, decreasing inflammation, treating inflammation. Three, worrying about managing comorbidity. And four, preventing infection with vaccination and screening. Here's a list of all the infections. Almost everything's been reported. TNF inhibitors, with rituximab, we worry about somewhat about mycobacteria, but mainly the JC virus, the PML virus, but also pneumocystis jirovecii. Abatacept, rare TB, tocilizumab, reactivation of hepatitis B. JAK inhibitors, a big time increase, up to a tenfold increase in the risk of herpes zoster infections. But you can see that we have to worry about these. So here are my safety rules to live by, especially when it comes to infection. The longer you're on a drug, the safer it becomes. Everybody thinks because you're on the TNF inhibitor, you're always going to have those worries. The risk of infection with TNF, especially opportunistic infection, is front-loaded. It's in the first 3 to 6 months. This applies to many of the other safety concerns. Taking less drugs is going to be a big problem. Lower doses does not mean the drug is safer. And generally, it means that the drug is less effective and inflammation becomes more dominant. Third, I am the best person to manage this drug and disease. You need to convince your patients of this. Never let someone who knows less than you manage the drugs that you're expert at. Playing it safe is both easy, stupid, and really risky. Number five, give your patient my rules. Write them down. Don't stop the drug unless you call me. Don't stop the drug if you have a fever. Tell them whatever you write down to put it on the refrigerator so they can always see it. If they don't know, call you. Safest is that it's best that the patient knows and accept that there's a low risk. They're bad enough to get on aggressive therapies or RA. There's going to be risks involved, is there not? Risk from RA, maybe risk of infection. And then lastly, risk from infection related to the drug. They can safeguard, their outcomes and avoid risk by knowing the risk and accepting the risk. Let's talk about cancer. A lot of questions about cancer. The risk of cancer in RA is roughly a one risk or an SIR of one. But that's not entirely true because there's an increased risk of lung cancer, skin cancers, and lymphoma. There's a maybe an increased risk of skin cancer, meaning melanoma. There's a decreased risk of colon and breast and head and neck and a few others. And nobody knows really the recurrence rates here. By the way, the risk of cancer associated with a biologic like a TNF inhibitor, it's exactly the same. The risk is not any higher unless the patient has really, really bad disease. Otherwise, RA patients sick enough to go on a biologic are going to get the same cancers that an RA patient who's not on a biologic, and that is a higher risk of lung, skin, and lymphoma, and a decreased risk of breast and colon. So blaming it on a drug doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I'm going to tell you when negotiating cancers that you have to worry about prior recurrent cancers, lymphoma, melanoma, family history of cancers, cancer at the onset of biologic or cancer that might have its outcomes altered by a biologic. And my view is number one, there's no drug-related risk of new cancers with the biologics we use. Sorry, there isn't. As I said, unless they have really bad disease. And that means all the risk factors and all the things I said you should worry about with infection. There's no risk of cancer recurrence with the drugs we use. That's not been proven. And there's no increased risk of dying from the cancer if you're on a biologic. My rule is you manage the arthritis, let someone else manage the cancer. Oh, a few tidbits here. The ACR guidelines 2015 said if the patient has a solid tumor, treat them as if they didn't have the tumor. You can use whatever you want. Pancreatic cancer, skin cancer, breast cancer, colon cancer, all solid tumors, prostate cancer. But yet you worry about it all the time. I do not. Next, when should you use or what should you do with in the face of a new cancer? 2021 guidelines were clear in stating that if you have a lymphoproliferative cancer, maybe your first choice is rituximab. I think that's idiotic and based on no data. If you want to look at the cancer data, there's tons of cancer data with TNF inhibitors, more so than rituximab, and that looks to me to be a whole lot safer. But if you want to know what the ACR guidelines say, they say use rituximab in the face of a lymphoproliferative disorder. There's no guidelines from EULAR about managing. Again, I think you need to manage the arthritis, let someone else manage the cancer. But communication. I'm worried about communication a lot. I think generally what I've learned in 40 years is patients don't want to know everything you know. They don't want you to be a fire hose of information and data. Talk less, listen more. Remember, no one remembers the data. Everybody remembers the story. So when given the opportunity, tell a story where you're conveying a risk or your approach. Always give the patient hope, goals, and rules. I like this quote from Seth Godin. People don't believe what you tell them. They rarely believe what you show them. They often believe what their friends tell them, more so than you, and they always believe what they tell themselves. So it's about the story that's in their head that they're worried about. You got to ask them, what are you worried about? Find out what the story is in their head. And then make yourself to be the expert. Tell them, I really want to take care of you. Tell them things like, this drug took $2 billion to develop and 10 years, was tested in 1,200, 2,000 patients, and further tested in 2 million patients worldwide. People exactly like you. This drug was made for you. But yet patients think that they have the sword of Damocles over their head. That means they have intangible, irrational fears that their life is chaos. And this has detrimental effects on decision making. Recognize that Fred Wolf outlined many years ago that patients are afraid to change. You have to overcome that obstacle. And the Ellsberg paradox means that people have, and this is not just patients, all of us have an ambiguity aversion. We choose that which we know, the story in our heads, and we reject that which we do not understand. So communication and confidence and trust has to be built if you want to do effective communication. And I like this slide about odds. I mentioned before, a 1 in 1,000 risk of getting a opportunistic infection or dying from a biologic, that's the same as dying in a house fire or dying from drowning. The risk of getting skin cancer is 1 in 5. The risk of getting any cancer is 1 in 7. But yet the risk of getting cancer in our trials with our biologics is always like 0.1 something, or certainly less than 1%. So knowing one of these numbers that you can convey is helpful. Some practice pearls. Everybody in my clinic fills out the symptom evaluation form. You can download this on Room Now. It's a follow-up visit form. It should be filled out by your medical assistant. Your medical assistant should be forced and taught how to get this completely filled out. On here is a global assessment, morning stiffness, a sleep evaluation, a pain score, a review of systems, their past medical history, their current new medicines, an ADL assessment in a modified hack, and a self-joint exam. This can free you up to do the important things in documentation and evaluation. Patients, and up to, I say up to 30, 40% of all visits are going to have fatigue, sleep, and hence some element of fibromyalgia that needs to be addressed. Use my sleep hygiene handout, hand it out to everyone, and don't be afraid to address either fibromyalgia or sleep. Rheumatologists are not that good at doing joint exams. It's kind of scary, but I advocate for doing Foley joint exams. And here's a clue. If the patient with the very first joint you touch has pain, and that doesn't matter if it's the big toe or left DIP2, the diagnosis is going to be the same as if they have Lagodynia. What's Lagodynia? You're doing the joint exam. You go from MCP 2 to 3 to 4 to 5. You get the PIP1, and the patient says, wait, that MCP 2 and 3 were kind of tender. Like, why couldn't they say it when you were squeezing on it? That's LIGO identity. People who have these two features are going to have fibromyalgia that you need to address. Please do so. It's important for effective management. If you don't do a full joint exam, Fred Wolf did the squeeze test on the hands, meaning the MCPs and the fingers, and on the toes and ankles and knees as well. And that was his exam. And Fred Wolf's one of the greatest rheumatologists in our history. But I'm a big proponent of doing either a 66 joint exam or 28 in every one, because it reveals something about everyone and there's no reason to not do it. And if you're doing telemedicine, there's no reason you can't do a telemedicine visit, and that's online that you can see. What do you do to diagnose carpal tunnel syndrome? You all do what, Tinel's test and Phelan's test, and those are the wrong tests. Durkin's test, the preferred test, has a 70% sensitivity. The Tinel sign, the thumping, we like to thump and percuss, that's part of being a doctor, only has a 50% sensitivity, as does the Phelan test. Phelan test is goofy. It's like some kind of secret society handshake to get into the club. It makes no sense. The Durkin test is when you put both thumbs over the carpal tunnel and squeeze for 30 seconds, and it will reproduce the pattern of paresthesias, numbness, whatever, in 70% of people. It's the test you want to do. Again, I do a joint exam on everyone. 28 joint exam is 2 minutes. I do a 10-second squeeze test on everyone, and I do a check for fibromyalgia tender points on everyone. You can do a 4-minute virtual exam by going on YouTube and look up the room now and the virtual exam, and it'll tell you how I do it. Always, communication is most important. I have pasted to every one of my computers when I see patients a little line that says hope, goals, and rules. It's mine to give to my patients. It's on the way to building trust. I hope you found this helpful. We'll be back at the podcast next week. Take care.